ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
This is the NT Country Hour on ABC Radio Darwin and the Northern Territory.
G'day there, my name's Matt Brand. Welcome to the program. In a moment, we will be crossing to Rockhampton, where Beef Australia 2024 is underway. It's the biggest beef event in the Southern Hemisphere. MLA has used today to launch a new tool for the cattle industry, which you'll learn about in a moment. Also today, you'll find out who won big on the weekend at the Daly Waters Rodeo and Camp Draft. And you've no doubt heard of the Hungry Hungry Caterpillar. But what about the Hungry Hungry Oyster?
The main thing is what they eat. And in the river, there's 18 different types of algae. And the Sydney Rock eats three. This one eats a lot.
An oyster that eats a lot and looks set to break a world record. Does Australia have the biggest oyster ever? You'll find out today on the Country Hour. It's May Day. And we are broadcasting across the territory on the ABC, streaming online. G'day there if you have downloaded our podcasts. We're going to start today by heading out to King Ash Bay in the Gulf of Carpentaria, which over the weekend held its first fishing competition of the year, which is great because you might remember this remote fishing community was hit really hard by floods in March following Cyclone Megan. King Ash Bay only reopened a couple of weeks ago. It's been a big cleanup to get things going. Ash Garner's the president of the King Ash Bay Fishing Club. Ash, before we talk about the competition there on the weekend, can you just remind our audience about what happened to the region after that cyclone?
Yeah, well, the cyclone itself wasn't too bad in terms of wind and things like that. I mean, we had a lot of trees down and that sort of thing, but not a lot of structural damage or anything like that to any of the properties. But the flood that followed, though, mate, was the biggest flood I've seen. And, you know, I've been down here for over 20 years now. And, the water got quite high. Predominantly, most properties got water through them. So, the flooding was the worst part of it.
I've seen some pictures that suggest the mud that was left over was significant.
Yeah, mate, yeah. So that's pretty much anyone that had properties or most properties that were on the riverfront, anywhere from a few inches to a few feet of water through them. And obviously when the water receded, those properties were left with, knee-deep mud right through them. So massive job to get it all cleaned up. But, as everyone does down here, mate, people hooked in and helped their mates out and got their places cleaned up, and we're operational again now. So, yeah.
A few tourists starting to come in yet?
Mate, it's shaping up to be a good season. The road to King Ash Bay, Batten Road, only opened up about 2 weeks ago. So, there's plenty of people in already, mate. So our powered sites are a chock-a-block there at the moment, mate. So it's going pretty good.
Great. And you had your first fishing comp for the year on the weekend. How did that all go?
Oh, excellent, mate. Excellent. A lot of people here. I think we had 130 entrants in the comp. And quite a few, and it was just a barra comp, so just a catch and release comp and a photo comp. We had well over 100 fish photos sent in, and plenty of good fish this year. Obviously, as we do every year when we get a good wet season, the fishing's pretty good. And this year's been really, really good so far. A lot of big fish getting caught. So
there's no money in tagged barra at the moment, but were there any tags found during the comp?
Not that I'm aware of, mate. I don't think so, no. But like I said, plenty of fish, though, mate. Plenty of good barra, mate. Lots and lots of good barra. Some really good fish, too. Up around that meter mark, some of the biggest fish were around that meter mark. So that was a great weekend, mate. Usually we have our Easter comp, which is our biggest event of the year down here at King Ash Bay. Obviously, we had to postpone that because, we weren't operational at that stage. Mm-hmm. And we'll move that comp. Our big comp down to September for the school holidays in September. Usually we run a smaller comp where it's just sort of barra catch and release once a month at least throughout the year.
And a lot of the NT's commercial crabbers operate out of King Ash Bay. What are you hearing about how the season's going?
Yeah. Well, I'm involved in that as well, mate. So I do commercial mud crab fishing. Started the season a couple of weeks ago.
Yep.
Not too bad. Obviously, you know, with a lot of fresh water coming down, I think the season's just a little bit later this year. But there's a lot of crab there, mate. A lot of soft crab, a lot of undersized crab, and some good quality ones starting to come in now as well. So it's, you know, shaping up. Looks like it might be a pretty good season.
And good prices for you?
It's not too bad, mate. Obviously, we compete with Queensland and other places at this time of year especially. But no, it's not too bad, mate. No, it's going all right.
And is it feeling like the dry season out there, Ash?
Yeah, mate. As I talk to you now, she's blowing about 15, 20 knots from the southeast and nice clear blue skies. Yeah, no, it's very much dry season at the moment, mate. So it's still a little bit warm during the middle of the day, but not too bad.
Beauty. Well, enjoy the rest of your day out there, and thanks so much for your time on the Country Hour.
Too easy, mate. You have a good one.
Hello there. My name's Norm Hedditch from Taruna Proprietary Limited, and we're Spanish mackerel fishermen in the Northern Territory, and you're listening to the Country Hour.
To some other seafood news. And this is big news. Starting next week, the Queensland State Government will place further restrictions on commercial gillnet fishing in the Gulf of Carpentaria. 5 new gillnet-free zones will come into effect as of next Friday, including around Mornington Island and right up to the Northern Territory border. These closures come on top of another 10 gillnet-free zones that were already in place. Queensland getting rid of the gill nets. David Rennie's the chair of the Gulf of Carpentaria Commercial Fishermen Association. He says the wild caught barramundi industry will be hit hard by these rules.
They've taken some very, very valuable, well, producing barramundi areas. And on top of that as well, they're implementing other enforcement, which is by this quota. Is going to come in. Cameras are going to have to be installed on boats. So it's just not area closures. Fishermen are getting hit fairly hard here.
What will it mean for the local industry there? Will there be fishos thinking about packing up and leaving the industry?
Oh, I believe so, because there's some family operations that work close to Corumba, and they don't have the means to fish very far away from Corumba. So, you know, and I know there's some fishermen up in Weeper exactly the same. So they'll have to make a decision where they invest back into the industry by buying boats and being able to move, or they just, it's a tough decision for them to make. A lot of these fellas don't know anything else. It's all I've ever done is commercial fish. So it means they'll have to leave town. There's not much employment in small communities like we've got. You know, you've only got tourism, commercial fishing, and the council, local council. Tourism is very seasonal. The council is very seasonal too. You can only work. It's usually only about, 6 to 8 months of the year that you can work. You've got to wait for the wet. We only just come off the wet now, starting to dry up now. So it's going to be pretty tough for a lot of people, very tough actually.
The Queensland government has put together a $12 million support package for impacted fishers. How far will that money go?
The East Coast got $180 million. For the East Coast, the Gulf gets $12 million. I mean, that's if you've got history on working in those areas, so you get a compensation package there. And then I've heard they've hoped to be able to do some buyouts. So we're not sure. It's only been announced on Friday. We're not sure, you know, what the money is for or how far it's going to go. What their packages are going to be. Yeah, so all that'll come out in time, I guess.
The Queensland government says these measures are being put in place to protect important marine species and protect marine ecosystems. Do you think the ecosystem is under threat?
No, absolutely not. No way. It's an unbelievable sustainable fishery that we've got up here. You know, I've been here and since 1989 fishing the Gulf here, and we're catching more fish today than we ever did back then. TEPS, threatened and endangered protected species, is a topic that everyone wants to talk about these days, and there hasn't been there've been some research into it, but not a lot of research. You know, fishermen are pretty good stewards of the ocean, and when they have interactions, they do their best to release the animals alive, and they become quite good at it. So yeah, it's pretty tough. It's actually real tough being a fisherman these days.
Do you think you'll be the last generation of commercial fishermen in the Gulf?
Oh, absolutely, without a doubt, we're the last. We're the last, without a doubt. You know, it's a dying profession, and there's a lot of people that just want to go to agriculture now, and imported fish. That's all they want to do. We certainly have the best or as good a quality as anywhere in the world is Australian seafood. We've been working under strict management rules for a long time, since the 80s. It's been strict, and you know, fishermen are getting less and less. There's less boats. It's all just got too hard.
It's David Wren, chairman of the Gulf of Carpentaria Commercial Fishermen Association, speaking to Dan Fitzgerald. In a statement from the Queensland Minister for Fisheries, Mark Ferner, he says the gillnet-free zones we're implementing in the Gulf of Carpentaria will give the commercial fishing industry the certainty that it needs to plan for a sustainable future. He says it will also enable us to meet our obligations to conserve important marine species and protect one of Queensland's most precious marine ecosystems. We've conducted a rigorous consultation process in formulating these zones and believe they strike the right balance between the environment, traditional owners and local economies. These new gillnet-free zones, they come into effect next week on May 17. This is what's happening on the Queensland side of the Gulf of Carpentaria. Is this a glimpse on what the future holds for fishos in the Northern Territory? It is 18 to 1, and you are tuned into the Country Hour, broadcasting across the Territory on this May day. Just quickly to the cattle industry. The benchmark Eastern Young Cattle Indicator this afternoon is sitting at 606 cents a kilo carcass weight, which is up 14 cents a kilo on this time last week. Now, the EYCI has long been the benchmark indicator for the nation's cattle industry, but is that about to change? Has it already changed? MLA has today launched what it calls the NICI. Now, what is it? How does it work? What does it all mean? I'll tell you next.
It's a Sunday, if you're catching Barra Monday, by the plains of old Pevmanah.
Across the Territory on the ABC, this is the Country Hour, and it's day one of Beef Australia 2024 in Rockhampton. And Meat and Livestock Australia has today launched a brand new indicator for the cattle industry. It's called the NICI, which is the National Young Cattle Indicator. MLA says the NICI is expected to be used as the most accurate national analysis tool of the restocker market. MLA's Steve Bignall had a chat to Kelly Buchanan about why this new indicator is needed.
So the NICI is a new indicator, the National Young Cattle Indicator, and what it is, it's a truly national restocker indicator. At the present, we have the EYCI, and that looks at processors, feedlots and restockers all in one indicator, and it sort of aggregates them, and so it can be difficult for producers to understand what the price of the category of animal they're selling is actually going for. So this is really a restocker indicator on a national basis that'll give those producers selling animals in the restocker market a guide to what they're worth.
And how is it formulated?
What it is including is it's actually our first indicator that includes both physical sales and online sales. So it will capture physical and online restocker animals over 20 kilos that are vealers, weaners and yearlings of both heifers and steers, and non-station mated. animals. So that's what's included in the NICI, and it will be reported in a live weight basis.
So I guess what's important to point out there is it's not the same animals that you might see in the eastern or western indicators. It's a different class of animal.
Yes, it's restocker only. So there are some restocker animals in the Eki. We do know that in the Eki, nearly 40% are going to feedlots and about 10% going to processors. So if a producer is selling an animal, a young animal, the Eki may not actually reflect the end market for the animal. This will be restocker specific. And what we hope that producers do is actually understand and take a bit of a nuanced look into the different indicators that we offer and that they match them up with the category of animals they're selling. So they will look at the NICI for restocker animals, the feeder steer for animals they're selling to a feedlot, and the heavy steer or processor cow for when they're selling finished animals.
Because the Eki has kind of, I guess, become an indicator that a lot of producers use to judge the sentiment of the market, but it's not always a good indicator of that, is it?
The Eki was created at a time when Australia was thinking about having a meat future, so it was in carcass weight. It was at a time when sale yards made up a far bigger proportion of individual transactions. And it also was created at a time when processors were far more active in the sale yard buying young cattle. And as time has changed, we've kept the Eki. It has sort of become the benchmark indicator that MLA offer. But there are questions around it.
How important was it for this to be truly national, to capture the western and central markets as well as the eastern markets for this particular indicator?
So with the Eki, if we're looking at processor animals and feedlots, there is sort of geographic requirements for that. When we're talking about restocker animals, being national is really important because what we saw in COVID during the recent drought-breaking rains in 2020-2021 is animals in the restocker market can travel. People were buying animals from the north when the southern Victorian area and New South Wales broke from drought in 2020. We do know in that restocker market that people buy animals from all over, and especially with the online platform being there, we do know that having a national footprint is more important for that restocker market.
Is it challenging to capture that data from both the online and in-person or live sales?
It's not. We launched the online indicators in November, and we've obviously had the physical data being collected by our LMOs way back to 2002. So we have spent a lot of time. This is not just been created today. There's been a lot of time spent in the back end ensuring that those two data sets can be merged and together they can create one indicator.
And you mentioned too that this is specifically live weight, which is another difference. Why choose to do it in live weight?
The Eki was created for a possible beef futures market, and that would obviously require the need for it to be in carcass weight. All other indicators are in live weight, and that is really the currency that producers think about when they are transacting cattle. So what we thought is it was important to have a restocker indicator that was presented in a live weight basis that reflects actually how producers transact cattle.
A lot of people will look at the Eki and look at the number and know it's over $10, that's extraordinary. It's, you know, down around $3, that's problematic. What do you think people will draw from the NICI? What will they, when they see the number, what do you think that'll mean to them?
Well, as it's a fully, truly restock indicator, it's actually going to give producers a really good understanding, and industry stakeholders for that matter, a really good understanding of sentiment in the industry. It's going to be a lead indicator because we saw in 2020 when the rains broke, the restocker element were paying a premium and were the ones sourcing those cattle and the most vigorously. So we knew that sort of preceded the demand from feeders and processors. And similarly, when prices sort of eased last year and there were concerns about the drought, restockers were the first to exit the market. So having a restocker indicator, a restocker specific indicator, will give industry a really good understanding of the sentiment and the future. It'll be a really good way to gauge the sentiment looking forward for industry.
I guess the comparison then, the Eki, because it includes the feedlotters and the processors, that's an indicator really of the confidence in some of those parts of the industry to buy. But the restocker really does give us that sense of future confidence, of whether or not people are prepared to carry more animals based on what they know is coming down the pipe.
Yes, exactly. So the restocker sentiment will look at if producers are buying heifers to build up their herd numbers, or if they're looking at buying some steers to add some weight to sell into the market, into that sort of feedlot or finished market down the track. So it will give us a really good indicator into what producers on the ground are thinking of doing.
And so how can people find and make use of the Nikki?
So the Nikki went live this morning at 8:30 this morning. The Nikki, as we're calling it, went live on the MLA website, and it can be found under the Prices and Markets page on the website.
That is Steve Bignell from Meat and Livestock Australia speaking to Kelly Buchanan about the Nikki. As he said, it's now live, and I can tell you that this afternoon, the National Young Cattle Indicator is sitting at 326 cents a kilo, which is up 23 cents on this time last week. The Nikki. It's been launched today at Beef Australia 2024. It is day one of this huge event, which is held every 3 years in Rockhampton. It's the biggest beef event in the Southern Hemisphere. More than 1,700 commercial cattle being judged at Rocky this week. It apparently takes more than 3 kilometres of portable fencing to keep them all in. Something like 120,000 people expected to attend this event. It's huge. Bryce Cam, he's the chair of Beef Australia. He has just spoken to the Queensland Country Hour, which is broadcasting from this event, and he was asked for his thoughts on how day one is going.
Look, it's been fantastic. It is 1,090 days since we closed the gates on Beef Australia 2021, and our team are very excited to be here, to throw open the gates here on People's Day for the first day. It's cracking weather here in Rockhampton, and we're expecting a crowd of over 30,000 people to join in the festivities of Beef Australia on day one.
It must be great to see the people back, because this is a very different beef to what we experienced in 2021, which was, of course, sort of in that window of COVID events. How has it been being able to see not just the people return, but also a lot of our international visitors? This has always been such a big event for connecting with international customers of Queensland and Australia's beef industry.
Kelly, you're absolutely right. The Australian beef industry is a globally facing industry. And unfortunately, we weren't able to have those guests in 2021, so it's a big feature of the program here in 24 to welcome back our international delegates. Just under 1,000 of those registered to be joining us here over the next 5 days. Greg Pankhurst and his international committee have put together a really great program, and we have people from right around the globe, which is so important, because it's important that those partnerships and trade conversations will be happening here over the next couple of days. And the demand for high-quality Australian beef globally has never been stronger. So it is great to have our international friends and visitors back with us again.
So when you sat down to consider what you might do differently in 24, what were some of the key challenges or conversations that you wanted to be had at this event? Because it is often, as much as we do like to get together as much as we can, a lot of the industry is either spread across the state, the country, or the globe. So what are you hoping are the conversations that are had at Beef?
Beef is a logistical nightmare, maybe, but it is a big act to pull together here in our beef capital, the regional city of Rockhampton. I guess one of the big focuses, and I said it in a speech last night, there is so much interest in the Australian beef space, be that from globally, but also from our own wider public, into where beef fits into the society's conversation. And so many of the elements across the symposium and the seminar program is really focusing on sustainability, but also the conversation about the importance that the Australian beef industry has to our nation and investing particularly in regional Australia. And so I guess my main takeaway for the board is really that this event and this platform embraces the entire beef community. We so often talk about supply chain and industry, but really, beef, there are people from all walks of life here over the next 5 days, and that is, it is that true celebration of what really is a great high-quality protein, but really brings together an amazing community. There'll be over 120,000 people within that community come through the gates here, and I, for one, it's a community I'm very, very proud to be involved in, and to have this opportunity to lead this event. And so I think I hope a lot of our participants leave these couple of days at Beef with a sense of pride and a sense of understanding where this community's place in a wider conversation.
You've done 5 Beefs. What's your advice for people on maintaining their energy this week? Obviously, I'm thinking high protein diet, but what keeps you, what gets you through this week?
I think it's the it's a lot of adrenaline and a lot of excitement because walking over here today through the crowds, there's a lot of pride and a lot of happiness out there. People are excited to be here, excited to be together, celebrating all things Beef. Beef Australia, it is the largest, now the largest construction of temporary buildings in the country, larger than the Grand Prix or many other events. So look, I think, yes, eating lots of high quality beef is the secret, but it is jolly good fun, and seeing and getting to celebrate with all of these people is really my secret energy tip to keep you going all week.
Bryce Cam, who's the chairman of Beef Australia. This ginormous event is underway in Rockhampton. If you're a bit like me and are suffering from a bit of FOMO on all of this, the Country Hour will be keeping you up to date as best as we can throughout Beef Week.
G'day, my name is Heather Smythe. I'm a sensory scientist and flavour specialist, and my job is to make food more delicious. And you're listening to the Country Hour.
Matt Brand with you this afternoon on this May Day. You've no doubt heard of the hungry, hungry caterpillar, but what about the hungry, hungry oyster?
The main thing is what they eat. And in the river there's 18 different types of algae. And the Sydney Rock eats 3. This one eats a lot.
Yeah, in a moment on the Country Hour, you're going to hear the story about an oyster called Jill. Jill's from New South Wales. And potentially is the biggest oyster ever recorded. Ever. Biggest oyster ever. And it's an Aussie called Jill. True story. It'll be on your radio in a moment. Let's go to the Weather Bureau. Rebecca Patrick is there this afternoon. How are you, Beck?
Yeah, I'm good, thank you, Matt.
That's the go. You a fan of oysters?
No, not really.
No. So the idea of sitting down to an oyster that's over 3 kilos is not... that's not really appealing to someone like yourself then.
No, I can't even imagine how you'd eat that.
It's full on. Because, you know, in this world, there's perhaps just 2 kinds of people. There's those who love oysters and those who feel like it's just snot in a shell. And imagine over 3 kilos of it. I mean, that's that's epic.
Indeed.
We'll talk about this giant oyster in a moment. Let's talk weather. The week ahead for the Northern Territory, is there much to report?
Not too much for the start of the week. We do have some dry air pushing up into the top end, particularly the western parts of the top end at the moment. Even up as far as Darwin, we have seen that humidity drop out during the day. And that'll continue tomorrow with perhaps a bit of increase in humidity for the second half of the week over the western top end. Still relatively humid in eastern top end. Not seeing too much in the way of showers at the moment for today, but expecting those to return tomorrow. Elsewhere across the territory, it's pretty sunny towards the south. Still getting those windy mornings through central districts. We are expecting a bit of a cloud band to develop on Wednesday, so we might see a little bit of rain or showers associated with that, mainly over the eastern districts. So eastern parts of the Barkly might get a bit, probably not a whole lot, probably okay. Most likely less than about 5 millimetres for the Barkly, but yep. heavier falls down through eastern parts of the Simpson district.
I get the sense those in the Barkly just are very keen for it to dry out. It's still quite boggy in so many spots. So
yeah, fair enough too. Well, So that's good news story, I guess. Not too much rain with that.
I see the Alice expecting a low of 5 degrees tomorrow. Ooh.
Yeah, it has been fairly cold in Alice Springs the last few days. I think their May average is around 8 degrees for that minimum, but yeah. It has been below that every night except for the 1st of May. So, it has been quite chilly down there and set to continue for another couple of days.
Okay, and just finally, what's the weekly weather forecast for the beef capital of this nation, Rockhampton?
Yes, I did have a quick look at that. Looks like the temperatures are fairly mild, sticking around 25 to 27 throughout the next week. Minimums around 17, 18 degrees. Looks like maybe a chance of some showers around from Wednesday.
Oh, okay. Because they copped a little bit of rain there on the weekend, which is great for the local cattle producers, but in terms of running this large event, it can make things challenging if it's a bit muddy. So they've got sunshine at least for the next 3 days, hey?
Yep. So from Wednesday, just a chance there.
Beauty. All right, then. Thanks so much for your time this afternoon, Beck. Appreciate it.
No worries. Thanks, Matt.
That's Rebecca Patrick there at the Weather Bureau. There are no warnings in place as we go to air this afternoon. It is 10 past one, just on the topic of Rockhampton and Beef Australia 2024. Here at the Country Hour, we've been made aware of a significant story for the beef industry, and that is that Brazil has declared itself free of foot and mouth disease without vaccination and will now be requesting that the World Organization for Animal Health recognizes that status. So that essentially means that Brazil, which is already the world's largest beef exporter, if it is declared free of FMD by the World Organization for Animal Health, it'll open up more market opportunities for Brazil. It'll be able to start sending beef into countries like South Korea and Japan. They are key markets for Australia. Now, what does all of this mean? We'll be talking more about this on tomorrow's Country Hour. Now, we've just had a chat to the Weather Bureau, and I was talking about how it's still a bit boggy out there in the Barkly. On Friday's Country Hour, we had a chat to Rusty Richter at Victoria River Downs Cattle Station, which has just had its biggest wet season on record, 1,359 millimetres in the gauge, which beats the previous record that was set way, way back in 1904. A huge wet season in the VRD, and as you can imagine, things are a little bit boggy.
Yeah, we've had vehicles bogged, we've had two-wheel motorbikes bogged, that's how wet the country is. We've had to do a lot of our floodgating and fencing through helicopters and just to try and keep ahead of the times, you know.
Yeah, it's boggy there at Victoria River Downs Cattle Station, but Rusty Richter, he is not alone. He is not alone. I've been told by a bunch of top-end cattle producers that it is very wet and there's been a lot of bogged vehicles over the last month or so. We all get a bit bogged from time to time. A few years ago, I caught up with some of the young guns of the cattle industry and got them to share their favourite, almost embarrassing, bogged stories.
Yeah, g'day, Jeremy Scott, overseer at Newcastle Water Station for Consolidated Pastoral Company. And yeah, my best or worst, most embarrassing bog story off the coast of Carlton Hill Station at the top of the Kimberley region. North Cunanar, bogged a 16G grader to the belly for 3 months with a camp van behind it.
I'm sorry, 3 months stuck in the bog?
The famous last words of, she'll be right.
So I just sat there for 3 months. Tell me about the day you got pulled out.
A lot of cursing, a lot of sweat, a lot of flies, and not much else.
Chev got stuck and the Ford got stuck, got the Chevron stuck when the Dodge showed up, but the Dodge got stuck in the tractor rut, which eventually pulled out the Ford with some difficulty.
My name is Ali Quintana and I'm the stud overseer at Newcastle Water Station. About 2 years ago, I was over at Bunda Station and we were putting lick out and I had the gooseneck on. and it just been raining, and we were trying to get the last block of lick out. And I had one kid in the car with me, and he was like, I think it's getting a bit wet. And I was like, oh, we should be right. We don't have far to go. Like, it doesn't look that wet. And then sure enough, we got stuck. And we always have this thing where if you get bogged, usually owe a cotton to the station or the rec club. And I did not want to say it over the two-way that I was bogged. And I was like, okay. So, and the only person I could get a hold of was the manager. And I was like, it's a bit slippery out here. We just might need a hand. And he ended up coming out, and he seen that we were bogged to, like, the axle, and he was not happy.
Were you able to keep it a secret from the rest of the staff?
No way. That was not possible.
How you going, Matt? Alex Brisson. I work at Amundi Station. I'm the head stockman there, and do a little bit of flying as well. My best bog story is I'd actually sent a couple of blokes lick running for the day just on the tail end of the wet there. And I flew over it in the morning, thought it'll be right, it all looks dry. Anyways, I've gone back, I've jumped in the grader, and I was just doing a bit of grading that day. Got a call from the blokes in the truck saying, what'd you send us down here for? We're up to the axles. I've gone, oh, righto, no worries. And so I got that grader going and started heading down to them and had a look at it, and I'm like, how'd you get bogged here? It's dry. It's, like, I don't know what you've done here. So then I've got the grader, and I've tried to drive around the side of him so I could pull him out forwards, and it's just completely sunk down to the belly as well. It was there for about 2 or 3 weeks until it dried off enough, and we ended up getting him out.
So you went to save them and got bogged as well?
Yeah, right next to him, probably about a metre's difference between where they were and I was. So you probably would have assumed I would have seen that it might be a bit wet there, but yeah, we had been to the pub the night before, so I don't reckon anyone was thinking too much.
We'd pull one truck out and get another stuck in, and motors would roar and tires would spin. We'd sink right down to the diff, and we'd all take turns and do it again until no one could move. We'd call one more friend, come on out here, we need you. Bring your truck.
G'day, my name's Mitch Taylor, working with DIT AgTech out of Katherine. When I was 17, I bought this new 2.8 Hilux and thought I was best thing since sliced bread. Anyway, rolled out and I was like, all right, got my peas, let's go. So I jumped on this sandy track, was going to do Road Beachport track. Anyway, got 10Ks down, went, oh, righto, yep, tracker in four, nah, bits off. So, yeah, anyway, got a bog to the axles and had to do the walk of shame all the way back home.
And did you say this is out on the beach?
Yeah, this is out on the beach, but it was a bit too high, so I wasn't in danger of...
All right, no tide, because that really increases the intensity of a bog, doesn't it, if the tide's coming in?
Yeah, no, I was lucky about that, but had to go back home and came the way back out and save her.
Was that literally day one of the brand new vehicle?
Sure was.
Wow.
The Chev got stuck and the Ford got stuck, got the Chevron stuck when the Dodge showed up, but the Dodge got stuck in the track.
We all get a bit bogged sometimes. I think there's a lot of cattle producers getting bogged in 2024. Some of the young guns of the industry sharing their favourite or most embarrassing stories with you on the Country Hour. I'm joined in the studio this afternoon by Dan Fitzgerald, not to talk about getting bogged, but to talk about this oyster, Daniel, the record-breaking oyster. There's a picture of it up on the ABC Rural website. The bloke, the farmer, looks like he's holding up a boot. It's huge, and it's an oyster.
It is a big, big, big oyster, Matt. It weighs in at just over 3 kilograms.
See, if you shucked this thing, you'd need a steak knife just to eat it.
A dessert spoon, yeah. To be honest, in my opinion, it's probably a bit too big. but it has won the title of Australia's biggest oyster.
Okay.
And the current world record for the biggest oyster worldwide, that goes to a Danish oyster at 1.6 kilograms.
It's a baby, really.
So it's got that covered easily. The official confirmation, it hasn't come through yet from the Guinness World Records, but the oyster farmer, Bernie Connell, he is waiting on that. He's been in the oyster game for 55 years, so he reckons he's that close to his 15 minutes of fame. This oyster in question, well, it's about 9 years old. Bernie, he's got pretty close to it. He's given it a name. He's called this massive oyster Jill.
Jill the oyster, yeah.
He says the trick to growing a big oyster, it's all in the diet.
The main thing is what they eat. And in the river there's 18 different type of algae. And the Sydney Rock eats three. This one eats a lot. That's why they grow so big. They never stop eating, they're just pumping all the time.
What do you have to do to Jill throughout the year to help her grow, or do you just leave her?
Well, she's in the best water, of course. You got to bring them back to the shed every 4 months and clean all the seaweed, little oyster catch on their mussels, clean that all off and put her back out. And I got her back in about 5 weeks ago, cleaned her all off for the show.
And so talk to me about, you said you've been a few years trying to get the world record for the heaviest oyster. Talk to me about that process.
Well, the world record is 1.6 kilo, and it was 32 inches long. And my first one I presented, it was 2.2 kilo, but it wasn't long enough. So they wouldn't give us the record. And we've been trying 5 years. Every year we come, they ring them and torment them, the Guinness Book of Record. So this year they're acknowledging that she'll get the world record if she wins.
And how does that feel?
Well, it's been, I say, 5 years waiting for it, so I might retire now.
That is Bernie Connell. He's a New South Wales oyster farmer speaking there to James Tugwell at the Naruma Oyster Festival out on the New South Wales south coast.
I just wonder what he's going to do with that oyster. What do you do with 3 kilos of oyster?
Well, he said he's about to retire, and the oyster might retire.
Retire with him.
Yeah. There's an online story up on the ABC website where you can check out this oyster. It is huge. It's way bigger than a hand.
Yeah, oh, yeah. Like, to me, it's a large boot. Bigger. There's a great photo of him, and I assume it's his mates and family. They're all on a beach, and he's holding it high in the hand. It'd ruin your shoulder holding that up. Unbelievable. Thanks so much for that, Dan. And yes, if you've got a bit of time this afternoon, head along to the ABC Rural website and go and check that out. Up next, after this tune by Tommy Curtin, we'll be checking out how things went on the weekend at Daly Waters. First camp draft of the year. That is Camp Draft In with Tom Curtin. It was a big weekend at Daly Waters with the Territory's first camp draft of the year taking place. And of course, there was lots of rodeo action there on Friday and Saturday night. Catherine's very own Warren DeWitt, he did well at the camp draft. He got second spot in the open draft, so well done to Warren. He had a chat to James Elton, said there was a big crowd that made the trip to Daly Waters.
Yeah, it was very good. It was well attended. They've obviously done some upgrades to the camp and to the camp draft arena, which was really good. They've made some great improvements down there, which made the cattle run much more calmly and much better for the competitor. So, yeah, it was a great weekend, actually, and the rodeo was really good as well. There would have been thousands there at the rodeo, and they had something like 900 noms for the camp draft. So that was not as high as it has been, but certainly given that this time of year, the wet season sort of hung on a bit longer, some of the people on stations weren't able to come into the draft because they were just starting to do their first round musters. So they're a little bit behind their time frame, I suppose, or where they normally are on the land.
Tell me a little bit about how you were feeling going into this event, because you hadn't been on a horse for some time. How are you feeling, and how did you think you were going to go? And I guess, how did that compare with how you actually went?
Yeah, I was very apprehensive because obviously I hadn't ridden the horses very much coming up to this draft because I was too busy fishing because the fishing was so good. So I hadn't taken them and done anything really too much with them, and I wasn't expecting them to be sort of anywhere near as good as what they were, but it was just like I hopped back off them and hopped back on them at September last year. So they were, and I love my horses, they're really well mannered, and they do, you know, do try really hard for you and all the rest of it. So yes, I was very worried, but lo and behold, I managed to fluke second place in the open, which was very surprising.
And because, I mean, some of those riders that you're up against there, I mean, someone had told me, watch out, like, watch Des Carey. He's one of the you know, very best horsemen in territory. And so you're in some very prestigious company there.
Yeah, it is. But, you know, you can go from the penthouse to the outhouse very quickly in camp drafting. So you don't want to sort of brag too loud because otherwise you know where you're going to be next week. So you take it while you can and enjoy it. And certainly, there are a lot of good riders down there. The Dailies were there. there was lots of other people there that were really good riders. Danny Groves, Danny Hayes. There's lots of good cattlemen and riders and people who work cattle, you know, on a constantly daily basis, I suppose, understand cattle, where people like me, I haven't seen a cow since September last year. So that was the first time this weekend that I'd actually sat on a horse with a cow in front of me. So it was a little bit daunting, but it was, but thankfully my horses were good enough and skilled enough to make up for my mistakes and get me around.
So what's next for you in the camp drafting world? Will you be continuing on the circuit?
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. I go to Mataranka as the next one, and then the Catherine Ash in Catherine Ears the following weekend. So there's about a two-week break before Mataranka, and then Mataranka, and then Catherine straight after. The Catherine Ash is straight after it, and then there's another number of other camp drafts that follow in line with that one as well, including the Catherine Show, which has got a camp draft on as well, which is a really big one that everyone attends every year.
Lots to look forward to. And in the meantime, I guess you walk away 2 and a bit K richer from prize money.
Yeah, I do.
Wonderful.
Which makes up for the $150,000-odd that I'm behind in all the other nominations and expenses. So my wife and my son quite often mention to me how much it costs to go camp drafting and also how much it costs to go fishing. So they're two of the most expensive sports, I suppose, that you can get yourself into. But I can tell you, they're the most adrenaline-filled sports that you can get into, and you become addicted to them once you sort of get into it a bit and learn the skills a little bit that you need to become a bit more comfortable with what you're doing. So fishing and camp drafting, you know, they're both the same, I suppose. One minute you can think you're king of the hill, and next minute you're down at the bottom of the pile. So it's a good leveler. And that's what I like about drafting. I mean, camp drafting and fishing and all that kind of stuff, it's not a given that you're going to do well every time you go into that camp. I mean, it's a matter of you, the beast, and the horse. You've got three things that you've got to try and control. You've got to get them all to come together to be able to successfully go around the course.
That is Warren DeWitt from Catherine. Big thanks to him for sharing his time. And well done, Warren. Coming second in the open draft. First draft of the year for the Northern Territory. A special congratulations to Robbie White from Rosewood Cattle Station, who took out the top prize there in the open draft. Tom Hall won the Maiden A. Kelly Daly, well done to Kelly, who took out the Maiden B. And Joe Brown took out the juvenile draft there in Daly Waters on the weekend. I wonder if you were some of the few thousand people in the crowd there over the weekend. Beautiful weather. I'm sure the local pub sold a few beers or five.
They roll back, check back, gate lock gear.
That's it for today's Country Hour. I hope you enjoy the rest of your May Day. If you've missed any of our stories from today or from last week, you can catch it all via our podcast. Keep it rural.